linguistic art chicks.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. So, here we are back together once again, and it's been another week. I actually believed myself when I said I was going to get a second podcast out last week, but as you can see, I didn't know what I was talking about once again. I wish I could tell you that I had a good reason for not podcasting sooner, but the truth is that time just slipped away from me. It's a good thing I don't have a real job, because I'd probably be worrying about getting fired for being so slack. But on the other hand, I'm finding life quite enjoyable at this non-corporate pace, and I highly recommend it. That is, if you can figure out a way to buy food, shelter, and clothing without going to work every day. But enough idle chatter. Let's get on with today's program. Now, one of the reasons I'm able to keep doing these podcasts is that I've been getting help to pay for the bandwidth and other podcasting expenses from some of our fellow saloners. And this week, I want to thank Andrew D., Philip P., and by the way, this is a different Philip P. from last week, so nice little synchronicity there, you guys. And also, we received a donation from another frequent donor, A Dime Short. So thank you to Andrew, Philip, and A Dime Short. Your support means a lot to all of us here in the Psychedelic Salon. And hey, A Dime Short, thanks also for that most excellent review on iTunes. I loved it. And for today's program, I also want to thank Dennis Berry, who is the trustee of the Futique Trust, which is the trust that holds the Timothy Leary Archives. Thanks to Dennis and to Bruce Damer, we've been given access to the recordings of some of Dr. Leary's speeches. And thanks for that also goes out to Rene Dalder and his students, who digitized this material for us. And soon, I'm told, much of this material will also be available at the Internet Archive, so you won't have to wait for me to podcast it all. However, I am going to do my part by playing another talk from this amazing archive right now. The talk we're about to hear was labeled Creation of the Future, but I think that today a more provocative title might be something like A Timothy Leary Take on Intelligent Design. Now, I hope that doesn't put you off, because in a way that you'll hear for yourself in just a minute, I think that this talk definitely has elements of that debate in it, but with a Tim Leary twist, of course. Now, when this talk begins, we hear a woman introducing Timothy Leary, and I'm almost positive that it is Grace Slick doing the honors. The date of this talk is sometime around January of 1979, based on some of the comments that Dr. Leary makes, and you'll hear in just a minute. Also, in this talk, we hear Timothy refer to his Cooper Union speech, which you can hear in podcast number 127. By the way, I've now heard that in addition to Tom Robbins being in the audience that night, Leary's archivist, Michael Horowitz, was also in attendance. And you can hear some of Michael's stories about those days in a recent podcast of Psychonautica by Max Freakout, which you can find at dopefiend.co.uk. And I think the Horowitz talk is in his podcast number 31. As you'll hear in a minute, Dr. Leary either had a continuous nervous laugh, or he was enjoying himself immensely. My guess is that he was just having a great time, as he always seems to do. And if I remember correctly, it was Marshall McLuhan who advised him to always be smiling whenever the press took a picture of him. And if you do a Google image search on Tim Leary, you'll see that the majority of pictures of him are of him smiling. And if you think about it for a minute, when some of those photos were taken, he had to really be hurting inside, particularly when they were taking him to prison. Here he was, about to be locked in a cage, and he was still smiling. I think that may be his greatest legacy, the gift of lightness of being. I know that I seem to take this life way too seriously from time to time, and so I think it's great to hear some truly innovative ideas presented in a very unassuming way. And to top things off, he made this presentation to what I would consider a very raucous crowd. All in all, I get the impression that Dr. Timothy Leary was having a great time on that January night in 1979. So let's join the crowd now and see how these remarks of almost 30 years ago hold up today.
I was going to make some semi-humorous comments about endless beginnings and metamorphosis and the cyclic intellect of the 60s in San Francisco, but this feels more like a sort of a kitchen laboratory where people are hungry, waiting for the real food. The appetizers were good, you know, but I can feel that gimme the food stuff. And I'm just as anxious to hear him as you are. So here he comes, the Commodore, Timothy Leary.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Well, I'm happy to be in San Francisco, the neurological Dodge City by the Bay. Privilege and honor to have Grace here tonight, and Paul and the members of the Starship. Thank you for being here. Could we have the lights so there's more lights on everybody, so that I'm going to demonstrate with scientific evidence, anthropological data, ethological reports, to anyone's satisfaction that for the last 4,000 or 5,000 years, freedom and intelligence and individualism has been moving in an unbroken chain from east to west. So that here on the banks of the Pacific Ocean, we obviously have assembled the most advanced nervous systems on the planet. It's a 21st century audience, so I'm going to try to give you a 21st century transmission. I'm also going to demonstrate with scientific evidence, clinical and anecdotal reports, that the suffering is caused by being in the wrong place at the right time, or the right place at the wrong time, and the obvious solution to the problem of suffering is to put your body, put your nervous system, and put your sperm egg supply in the right place at the right time. And I think tonight is such a time. You know, the geologists have just let the awful truth out of the closet. The tectonic plates that are active in this hemisphere are moving in such a way that California, as you probably know, is steadily moving upward and westward. At the same time, the rest of the United States is moving southward and downward. So, as we float upward and westward, the minor little perturbations as we separate, of course, are known as these minor Richter faults, but I sure want to urge anyone who wants to continue to grow and get smarter, when the big quake comes, be on the California side. I go around the country lecturing, and there's simply no question. I'm an intelligence agent. I'm out there picking up reports and reporting back to you what's going on. The real action, in the sense of any sort of individual anarchy or energy and dynamism, is in the Sun Belt. I literally do go up to a place like Buffalo in the middle of winter, and I say, Buffalo's an intelligence test. You failed. And you're going to have to repeat Buffalo 1A over and over again until you realize that we're not supposed to be bundled up. I really want to send out some electricity tonight and to get all of our nervous systems vibrating and shocked and moving, because I feel, as I'm sure you feel, that it's time to start sending out signals of intelligence and precise hope again. And certainly this is a place we can get such a an activity started. Tonight reminds me in some ways of a lecture that I gave in New York City in 1964, just some 15 years ago. We had left Harvard, Richard Alpert and Ralph Metzner and others, and I was invited to give a lecture at Cooper Union. It's a very East Coast shrine, like, you know, the Acropolis or Canterbury Cathedral. And I was sitting in the dressing room backstage, and the man that ran this adult education for Cooper Union, whatever it was, came in the room. I remember this is 1964. Jimi Hendrix was an unknown left-handed guitar player in London. The Beatles were, they hadn't done Sgt. Pepper. Bob Dylan was hadn't gone electric. This was in the primordial period. I was in the dressing room, and this very important man came in. He was the dean of the adult education, and he looked at me the way I was dressed. I had on a blue work shirt, blue jeans, tennis shoes, and red socks, because we were definitely sending a signal out to the adult authorities that we were not going to play that game anymore. So he looked at me, he said, "You can't give a lecture at Cooper Union without a coat and a tie. Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt and John Foster Dulles have spoken in this hallowed hall." So I said, "Well, you're going to have to tell everyone to go home, because so forth." So I came out to this East Coast audience, and I said, everything that I have to say tonight can be summed up in one sentence. You have to go out of your mind to use your head. And there was a pause, yeah. Then there was an applause. Now, this is 1964, so that was encouraging. And I said, okay, that took 1 minute. We got 59 minutes more, so I can just tell you stories to illustrate on the basis of scientific evidence why this is true. And at that time, the hot scientific issue had to do with imprinting. Ethologists like Conrad Lorenz and Nico Tinbergen, who got the Nobel Prize later, had been studying animal behavior, fowls and mammals and primates, and they found that there was a form of learning which took place totally in violation of all the laws of Skinnerian psychology, that animals seemed to have a one-shot learning, which they created a new reality. This was called the imprinting period, the critical period. And I was telling them stories about you can take, any animal, any fowl during the early periods is a critical period when whatever it sees there, it imprints as being the reality. And they were training animals to imprint ping pong balls. They had a goose that would imprint a big orange basketball. Well, for the rest of the life, that goose went around trying to suckle the basketball. When it got older, it tried to make the basketball. Couldn't score, but kept on trying. In other words, the entire game was being played with the object that was imprinted at the time. There was the great story about the hunters that shot a giraffe. When they drove the Jeep over, they found out that the giraffe had a little baby. As the hunter's Jeep moved close, obviously what happened was that the baby giraffe imprinted the Jeep, because for the rest of the giraffe lives, it paid no attention to lady giraffes, but always trying to mingle with, sell life insurance to, or fuck Jeeps. Which led to the uneasy... Now, scientists never apply these findings to the human situation, because if they did, the uneasy possibility would develop, like what orange basketballs and other peculiar objects did we imprint during the many critical periods of our development. Well, that was hot stuff back in 1964. And although even today your classic textbooks in psychology don't, they talk about imprinting, and they imply that possibly imprinting might have something to do with the human situation. But no scientist or no human hive can face the possibilities of imprinting, because the whole thing gets pretty silly until our species has arrived at a point where you can do something about imprinting. Because none of us wants to think that we've just robots reacting to something that was accidentally there when we first came on the scene. So the concept that developed at Harvard and then at Millbrook and later seemed to have moved out to other places was the concept of serial imprinting, that for thousands of years the smartest women and men have known that through manipulating your nervous system, by getting high in any way that you can suspend the old imprints and have a chance to start a new reality because, as we all know, in sophisticated San Francisco, we all live within the reality bubble that our nervous system projects. Now, still today, they don't give this concept enough credit, although there are about 40 million Americans who regularly practice the art and science of serial re-imprinting and aesthetic and other experiments, which I need not detail. Now, I didn't hear you. What? Spike the punch. Spike the punch. Yeah. I'm still fighting some of my legal cases, and I'm out on parole, and the reporters are always asking me, well, what illegal drugs do you take? So for a while I said, well, I don't do anything illegal, immoral, fattening, or that would please Ralph Nader. More recently, I was married December 19th. That's a little over a month ago. My wife Barbara is here tonight, and I want to... Barbara, where are you? Now, I'm not advocating anything, but I think fusion is wonderful. I want to make a few scientific generalizations tonight based upon my survey of the current literature and current science fiction. Because science fiction always creates the science fact of a generation or two later. I'm sure we all know that. The great honor to any society goes to the science fiction writers. You know, Jules Verne wrote that story about the trip to the moon. It was over 100 years ago, and he had his rocket the same size as Apollo, left from Florida, went up there about the same amount of time, and landed within 200 miles of where the Apollos were landing in the Pacific Ocean. Now, science fiction writers have a certain power, don't they? Well, I want to summarize for you some of the hot ideas in science today, which have never been applied to our situation because the adult authorities around the hive, of course, want to use scientific breakthroughs to do the normal things, you know, make war and make money. And they're not too happy about individual members of the hive being really up-to-date and alertly tuned into new scientific developments, which might give power to the individual. Now, of course, if I at times poke fun at the adult authorities who run our hive, I'm sure you know that there's not one sense of bitterness or anger in me. I mean, after all, we won the Super Bowl, and it would be unsportsmanlike of us to complain about dirty playing by the Nixon group or whatever in the second half. Now, in the 60s, we were all concerned with neurology. It was the head trip. We all knew that it was, since it was our brain that created reality, you had to be pretty careful about shooting your neurological film, and you had to get the right set and setting and the right personnel. In other words, the shooting, your life became all like a movie. You know, you have to get the right location and so forth. Neurology was the real revolution of the 60s. You're never going to read that in your... Hello? Yeah, psych. Oh, yeah, San Francisco, 20th century, right. So I'm going to be summarizing for you tonight the scientific issue, which is going to be hot in the next 5 or 10 years. Using the neurological advances we made in the 60s, we can now begin to understand what evolution is all about. So I'm going to be talking about evolution. And the generalization I'm going to make is that your theory of evolution is the key to your own personal development or your understanding of what's happening around you. And far from being a textbook situation argued about by Darwinians and fruit flies, your theory of evolution, your theory of evolution determines really what kind of a life you're going to lead. Now, and right down the line, I want to tell you, the orthodox genetic biological theory of the United States today is exactly where psychological theory was in the late 50s and early 60s. They are trying to sell us a theory of evolution which is so ridiculous and so ludicrously useful to them and not to us that it's becoming clearer and clearer that your concept of evolution determines where and how fast and with whom we're going to go. Now, I'd like to tell you some animal stories. The point I'm making is that we are not here as a result of blind chance, statistical accident, copying errors. I'm sure you know that the classic theories of evolution claim that life began down here when sometime in the Precambrian ooze, there were a bunch of ammonia molecules, and they were having a party one night, and they invited some methane molecules, and some hydrogen boys and some oxygen girls dropped by, and the joint was hit by lightning, and they began to fuck. I mean, can you believe that? Now, they never explain, you know, exactly how the self-replicating mechanism comes. Yeah, it's clear that you can produce prebiotic amino acid molecules that way, but there's still no explanation in these orthodox textbooks as to exactly how the sperm-egg flirtation began. The Darwinian theory of natural selection is being overthrown now. Now, we have to give great honor to Charles... Yeah. Lied! I'm not doing any dishonor to... Oh, by the way, here's what I think we should do tonight. I've got an enormous amount of intelligence information to transmit. On the other hand, we're all active people and don't like to sit for a long time. So I'm going to talk for about a half hour more, then we'll take a break, and I'll come back and talk for another 40 minutes. Also, I urge you not to be polite. San Francisco requires rowdy crowds. So think of it as a rock concert. I mean, we got some of the greatest rock musicians in the world here. Please move around and, get it on. Or I'll really be irritated if any one of you sits through more than a boring minute. All right. Now, there's one other problem, of course. In dealing with an audience of this sort, which is a very 21st, 22nd century audience, there's a tremendous variety in nervous systems because we know as we evolve, we get more complicated, more unique, and our uniqueness and intelligence allows us to make higher liaisons and better link-ups. But there's a tremendous, tremendous variety of nervous systems in this hall tonight. In the old days, if you gave a lecture, you were either for communism or against it, or for Catholicism or against it. The Middle East are still going on that way. But here, I see some happy amoeba floating back there, and I see some wild, romantic, feudal barbarians galloping around over there, and I see a lot of 23rd century people flying around, so. See, the problem is this, that to talk, to send signals, we have to scope and scan, and these nervous systems are dialing and tuning, so if we get to a point where I seem to be digressing, we have two possibilities. One, you can think you're stupid, and we know that's not true. The other is that I'm a brain-toasted acid head, and just be patient. The third possibility is we're all moving so fast that we're here and back, and if you like, miss me for a second, I'm going to be zapping through in a minute, so don't worry. All right. I'm going to tell you some animal stories. The point is that evolution is not accidental. The Darwinians would have it, you believe, that not only was it an accidental thunderbolt in the Precambrian mud that started it, but that all evolution and differentiation of form has been due to accidents, copying errors, carbon copy smudges, and that if it hadn't been any accidents, we'd all be happy unicellular amoebas sucking and floating. Now, I'm not here to knock sucking and floating, but obviously there's more to handling this planet and off than that. So I don't believe that we're here as a sequence of errors. I don't think that 3.5 billion years could take us from the amoeba to Howard Cosell and Monday Night Football. I mean, no way. It's got to be, there's an intelligence behind all this. For example, I cite you our friend, the monarch butterfly. Okay, suppose we're all hanging out in a Mendocino forest, and there are all these insects running around, crawling, and there are two caterpillars doing the same insect thing, eating and crawling, and so forth. Then suddenly the two caterpillars get cocoons, and what happens? They come out. But they come out different. One is a beautiful phosphorescent, psychedelic, lemon, green, blue butterfly. And the other one is a monarch. The monarch butterfly then, as you know, starts, if it's the right time, the right generation, the right time to make the move, because not every generation does it. I repeat, not every generation does it. I repeat once more, not every generation does it. But some generations of monarchs start flying south. They fly from 4,000 to 7,000 miles south to exactly the tree where their psychedelic great-grandmother or father were three generations before. The exact same tree. Now, how do you account for that? The distance would be, in terms of the human body and the mileage, would be what? Going around the world by on foot, you know, 10 times. How do they do that? Now, the Darwinian theory would tell you that it's all accident. Some monarch headed for San Francisco and somehow the weather pushed it over to Almeida, and then, you know, it didn't get eaten because, you know, and because the Darwinian theory says it all. Listen, the Darwinian theory is a male macho prim theory. It's total sperm aggressive intelligence. Yeah. Those that fight best and fuck most spread the sperm, and the lady monarchs just say, hey, yeah. It's all plain. Oh, I should say, I started saying before, I give great honor to Charles Darwin. He belongs in the Genetic Hall of Fame. He had a tough situation to deal with. It was his unhappy task in the 19th century to deal with between 2,000 and 3,000 years of monotheism. And they had to fight this notion of creation that a male, macho, shepherd, paranoid, FBI-type god did it all in 7 days and said, it's mine, and anyone doesn't do what I want or eats tree, you know. Particularly, he didn't want you to eat the tree, the fruit of that second tree, which was the fruit of longevity and life extension and mortality, lest we become like him. See, now Darwin had his work cut out for him. So in order to deal with this Judeo-Christian concept, Darwin had to go to the opposite extreme and say, there's no intelligence whatsoever. Because intelligence, an intelligent creator, you know, leads right back to the... Because, you know, it couldn't. Darwin couldn't conceive of the fact that if the thing was done by an intelligent design, it had to be a man, right? And the fact, the possibility that it wasn't a man was something that had to be dealt with at the time. Why did Darwin have to do this? Well, because monotheism is over. And he was the hitman. Now, 3,000 years before that, monotheism was necessary. You had a bunch of tribes running around, and each tribe had its own little gig. One would carve wood, and the other would carve stone, and one would do that. So you had to have some megalomaniac male. You had to have a megalomaniac male saying, I had the divine power to pull these enormous tribal groups together so that they could build the pyramids, so they could build the great mathematical design institutes of Babylon. You had to have that, because an enormous anthill with millions of humans, they can't be screwing around by God. There's one God that runs it. And in the Judeo-Christian situation, of course, it's a hymn. Now, that was Darwin's situation. He had to deal with that. So the Darwinian theory, I mean, it's a locker room joke. According to the Darwinian theory, when the male hurtles between 400 and 500 million sperm into the female reproductive tract at each ejaculation, I repeat, 400 to 500 million sperm, then ensues, are you ready? Countdown, the greatest race in history. Can you imagine 500 million sperm doing Mark Spitz swimming? The scenario apparently ends that when they get to Miss Egg, she's waiting there, and she said, the first one across the finish line, gets, come in, baby. Now, how playing fields of Eden can you get? I was at a cocktail party once, and a biologist came up to me and said, well, congratulations, Timothy, you were the one that made it. I said, what do you mean made it? Yeah. Well, you were the one that swam the fastest and got to the egg first. I said, are you crazy? I didn't run. I floated with the tide up there watching carefully, and I studied exactly what she liked and didn't like. And I saw her laser shoot down all those macho athletes. So finally, at the right moment, I showed up with flowers and perfume and whatever was needed to let her know. And she said, I want you! See, evolution is very important. If you read the Scientific American 3 issues ago, the entire issue was devoted to evolution. And over, they went right down the list of all the basic tenets of orthodox evolutionary theory. And 7 out of 8 were wrong, and 7 out of 8 were wrong exactly in the way that would keep us from realizing that we can change, we can mutate. For example, the old theory, by old I mean the ones that they're still teaching in your colleges, says that new speciation takes tens of millions of years to create a new species. Well, if that's so, let's go back to quaaludes, huh? Why bother? Well, the facts of the matter are that's not true. In the right time, at the right place, with the right chemicals, and evolution leaps and jumps, and quantum jumps, and quantum leaps. And speciation. See, what's coming back in phase, because everything comes around once again, is Lamarckianism. Remember, Lamarck said that what happened in the lifetime of the individual was reflected in the species. Now, in the gross morphological bodily thing, it isn't true that if a carpenter does this a lot, his daughter or his son is going to have enormous biceps. It's not acquired characteristics in the neuromuscular mechanical sense. But you got to believe that she's smart. You gotta believe that she's using every technique of intelligence agents. You gotta believe that maybe we are her intelligence agents out here with our nervous systems picking up information. You got to aesthetically entertain the possibility that the DNA biological guy wisdom knows exactly what's going on all the time. And a matter of fact, once you look at the scientific reports, you see buried away little articles which have the implications so staggering that because they prove that DNA is picking up information not only during lifetimes but even from season to season. I cite you, for example, the case of the foxes in France. Because of urbanization and mechanical agriculture, the fox population of France was almost obliterated. So some French naturalists found a few, they call them dens of foxes, and studied them. And much of their surprise, they found out that the fox mothers were giving birth not to 2, but to 7, 8, or 9 in the litter. And the ratio of female to male was about 3 to 1 in favor of the female. So instead of 2, 1 male, 1 female, you were getting each fox litter with 3, 4, or 5 females. Now, that means that in one generation, the foxes looked around the neighborhood. They went down to the old corner disco, and they say, hey, what's happening to us? CNS, central nervous system, reports that to RNA, and RNA say, hey, we're in a little trouble up there. So the biological genetic dial is turned. Now, you know what happens if they get too many foxes in one space? The dial will be turned down again. Are you enjoying this? Am I being too scientific? Yeah? All right, I got the message. Okay. If you want, when I come back or later, I'll talk about the 60s and the 70s. What? All right, well, all right, I'm going to tell you one more animal story, and then we can draw some implications from that. How many of you saw that television special on the termites, narrated by Orson Welles? Wow, boy, they couldn't let that out in prime time. It was too hot. The sociobiology, behavioral genetics, the new hot philosophy and sociologies are based to a certain extent on analyses of social insects and social animals. Now, the termite hive is the most successful terrestrial social situation. The termite hive has been around for 100 million years. Now, the human species goes back in our form, what, 10,000, 20,000, 100 million years. The dinosaurs came and went, and, you know, glaciers came and went, and the termite hive had worked out the perfect social situation. They have got down terrestrial living. They're the smartest terrestrial creatures, apparently. The way they do it, they use two techniques, which are obvious techniques. Like if you're her trying to spread your intelligence agents into every ecological niche and every square millimeter of a planet and beyond, you certainly would realize that the way to increase the intelligence and therefore the aesthetics and therefore the harmony and the fun of your species would be to have what's called temporal and structural casts. Temporal cast means that you go through stages, like metamorphosis. That the at a certain age, a small ant plays one role, taking care of the babies. At a larger, a little older, it works around the hive. A little older, it goes out on errands. A little older, it gets to do guard duty. A little later, it gets to be rock and roll ant. You know. There are also specialized functions, or what are called castes, in an anthill. Now, you know, the warrior ants and the worker ants. Now, there is a direct, immediate relationship between the egg queen of the hive, who in size would be about twice as big as this room compared to one of us, if we were rock and roll ants, termites. The queen simply gets information from everything that's going on around and produces exactly the castes of ants that are needed. For example, if there's a war outside with the red ants, you know, the capitalists or the communist ants, whatever they call them, and we've suffered some losses. Maybe we lost 50,000 of our glorious warrior ants. The word is passed back to the egg intelligence. How is it passed on? Well, this is another one of the amusing aspects of biology. You know, they never really think through the implications of what's going on. Most biologists scorn the ants because you know how ants communicate? They don't have the Reader's Digest. They don't have Channel 4. They communicate by spit. I don't want to shock anyone here, but I want to tell everyone in this room that every time you put your tongue in the mouth of a loved one or vice versa, you are exchanging more information in 1 second than all the Library of Congress is in history. So, the word is passed back until, chain by chain, until egg wisdom gets the word, we've lost 50,000 warriors. So she simply turns the dial, and for the next few hours, a day or two, what are produced? Warrior ants. For example, if there's a drought and no water out there, hey, she's getting that message. She then turns up the dial and creates a cast of ants who can dig down 10 to 15 feet, which would, for us being digging down like 5 miles, to bring up one drop of water, which is put above the egg supply, and so forth. Now, there's one final thing I'd like to tell you about the termite ants. It sounds rather dull, doesn't it? I mean, year after year going on, millions of years going on that same ant. Of course, each ant hill is designed with more architectural perfection than our Gothic cathedrals. Each ant hill has to be in tune with the ecological situation, the nature of the soil, the amount of the city, and so forth. But it's still kind of dull. So what happens after when the right time comes? When the right time, because blossoming is always a matter of time, when the right time comes, she turns the dial and produces a new species of ants. This new species of ants are about five times bigger than the ordinary ants. And they've got wings. They've got wings that go from here all the way over to there. Glorious silver blue wings. But see the problem. You all know the problem. Everyone in this room knows the problem of the winged creature inside the hive. How are you going to get out? So, she's got it all taped out. She creates other groups of ants who make runways. And slowly, slowly, almost floating, come the silver ants out, out, out. They begin to fly a little, and they circle the enormous hive, which can be the shape of a mushroom, can be the shape of anything that fits the terrain and the ecology. And when they totally cover the hive with these shimmering, quivering, silver-blue wings, at that moment, they all move out. Why all the way around? Because she wants to make sure that it's a 360-degree circle. The female ants move first. They fly a certain place, feels good, and the female ant descends, sends out a perfume, beats her wings so the perfume goes out, and in time, she's joined by a male ant. The minute they kiss, they drop their wings, they make love, take one look at the sky, and they burrow down into the ground to start a new planet, or a new, whatever you want to call it. Okay, one more scientific fact, and then we can go on to conclusions. Every woman in this audience, shortly after conception, while still in the uterine condition, each woman in this audience was given 1 million eggs. That was your egg supply. It was to last you through your assignment on this planet. Every month after adolescence, one or two of this enormous supply of potential species intelligence is dropped down the fallopian tube. Fallopian tube. Dig that word tube. Tube's in. I was on a television program in Los Angeles with a very nervous announcer, and I began talking to him. I said, looked right in the camera. I said, do you realize every woman watching this program has 1 million eggs? And the announcer says, more or less. I said, yeah, more or less. tube isn't one of those four-letter words that you're not allowed to say in public. So, now, if I'm a domesticated primitive primate from the late 20th century, moving quickly into the 21st century. But if I can figure out a better way to handle that than the Darwinian scientists come up with, I'm sure that the biological intelligence worked it out. I would certainly not let the intersection of sperm and egg, which is going to determine exactly the future of the species, I would not let that be up to chance. So here is a situation. You have 1 million eggs in the female, and you have each lovemaking 400 to 500 million sperm. I don't think that's chance. If there's ever a time in the history of a species when you'd want to bring to bear all the evidence, all the data, all the precise anticipations of what needed out there, I think that genetics and obstetrics and gynecology is going to be published very soon, a lot of data which indicates that the period of ovulation is a period of tremendous selectivity. And based upon the information that your nervous system is giving the egg machinery inside the body of every woman in this hall tonight, I think decisions are being made. Now, I'm not saying this is definite, but it sure is a lot more fun. It's a lot more hopeful. It's a lot more optimistic. It's a lot more aesthetic. And you either believe in nothing whatsoever except chance, or you're going to believe in a biological intelligence which knows what she's doing. I think, as I said before, that the intersection between the one of the 400 million sperm and that egg, which is like exactly at the time, is the intersection of species future creation. What? Ask them right now. Pardon? What did you say? I'm doing my best. What happened in the 60s? Okay, I'll the 60s was a genetically designed and programmed pedomorphic revolt against adult authority. Another techniques used by egg intelligence. I'm going to answer your question. Give me a little warm-up, okay? All right. I dedicate this one to you. I hope you like it. geneticists have also found out something interesting about how evolution works. Now, remember, they don't really want to know too much about how evolution works, because the more they realize how precise and how aesthetic and how wonderful it works, then they can't talk about chance anymore. But one of the obvious techniques that biologists have discovered is used to create evolution. It's this fact, that species only evolve from the juvenile or the larval or the pre-adult form. The adult form is the specialized form. Hello.
Are the space people coming?
We are the space people, and we are going.
When are they coming? Where are they coming?
Well, we could be them.
Are we them?
I am. Barbara is. Consider us on loan from the 21st century. Yeah. Oh, listen. Oh, yeah. Well, I'll get to that later. I'm sure that most of the people in this room had that discovery early in life. You looked around at the adults, at the uncles and the aunts and the grandparents, and you watched what was going on in the adult world, and you felt out of place. You felt quite alienated. Now, if you were lucky, you didn't make this show. You didn't blurt it out. They didn't send you off to a mental health clinic. But if I were going to make any suggestions, egg intelligence, and I'm not really, but I'm sure she's considered this possibility, that at any one time, as our species travels as a huge egg ship through time, generations moving through time, at any one period, you'd want to have half of the people being born with future nervous systems and half with past nervous systems. You have to have your roots. You have to keep the... we don't give anything up. We still got a paleolith brain. We've still got an amoeba brain. We've still got a reptile brain. But I'm sure that most of the people who have felt alienated, I think many of the people who are put in mental hospitals are people that simply were born with nervous systems that were, we call, futique, as opposed to antique. Now, the point here, see, is if you're going to feel, synced, you've got to be in a place where there are people who share your reality. And if you've got a 21st century nervous system which doesn't get off on 4-foot mammalian barnyard politics, then you got to get your nervous system to a place where it can hook up and create realities with those that share your time. The key to your brain is time. Brains are cranked out by DNA just like models of Porsches, 79, 52, and so forth. And it's all necessary. There's no good guy, bad guy scenario here. Some are I'm a robot. I admit it. I have no choice. From the first time that I looked around and I saw what was going on, I just felt that I had to move the whole thing up to my time. Now, the trick of doing this is simply geographical. I got a new book coming out called The Intelligence Agents, and the main part of the book is neurogeography, that where you are determines which circuits of your brain are being used. See, if you're in Belfast, Ireland, you've got a 15th century or 16th century brain, because all you're concerned about is Catholics killing Protestants and Protestants killing Catholics. In general, the farther east you go, the more, do you see what's happening in Iran? I mean, how could that happen in Iran? Iran had all the oil, it had all the computers, it had all the electronics, it had the bring-in discos. I mean, what do they want to complain about there? They want to go back to the 8th, 9th, and 10th century. Pakistan, paper today, said the guys running Pakistan are going to bring back the old Islamic code. They're going to cut off the hand of a thief. Women go back in veils. There's not going to be any more education, which means Pakistan is going to give up, trying to become a modern country. Now, what happens? What's going to happen in Iran? What's going to happen in Pakistan? And this Islamic movement is going all through the East, Middle East. What's going to happen is... those Pakistanis who have to be educated, who have to learn how to do physics or have to learn how to play rock and roll, are going to move as far west as their nervous systems will gear them to. So to be in the right place means to be in the right time. It's so simple. That to be in the right place, you're in the right time. Tune the place you are to the vibrations of your the brain circuits that you want to activate at the time. Now, there are times when you want to be an amoeba. There are times when you want to, gallop around like an athlete or like a... times you want to charge out in the woods and become a mammal. Great. But I didn't answer your question because I dedicated that one to you. All right. Now, let me answer his question. I just said, future people are here. Well, lots of them. I don't know if you are, but lots of us here. There you go. How about a show of hands? How many space people here? Now, let me answer his question. The way evolution works... the way evolution works is this. Evolution never tries to change grown-ups. When you go home tonight, look in the dictionary for the word adult. You'll find the word adult is the past participle of the verb to grow. It says, adult, that form of a species which is no longer metamorphizing and has reached its final stage. Adult means over-specialized. So DNA knows better than to try to screw around with that. Now, pedomorphosis, or neoteny, is the technique used by DNA that at a certain moment, and it's all due to success, which gives you pollution and overpopulation. Now, I know that ecological consciousness has made us all aware of the pollution. Now, the way to do away with the pollution, of course, is not to stop all technology. The way to, first of all, you have to understand that pollution is a signal that triggers off the next movement in our nervous systems. So when I say the pollution is a valuable sign of pain, it's a signal to activate our nerves. Now, let me give you an example. I cite you the example of a beehive, because we're so close to pollution as humans, we don't want to hurt Ralph Nader's feelings or anything. So let's talk about a beehive. We'll call that Beehive America. We'll say this American beehive came into this incredible clover patch, and they were fast moving far out, individual bees anyway. They all escaped from the old hives because they had some dissident Quaker Shaker Thomas Jefferson restlessness. Anyway, these American bees get this clover patch, and it's fabulous. It's the best beehive that's ever been. They went out there and they got the clover. That is fantastic dance. Communication was terrific. They come back to the hive and make honey. More and more honey. More honey, the more you make love. More you make love, the more bees. The hive got to be the most successful, fast-growing hive in history with the best communication system. However, some of the older bees finally looked around and said, what's happening to this hive? There's too much noise of all those wings, too many bodies. Look at all that bee shit on the floor. I mean... This, I mean, we got to cut this out. I don't want as much honey. Don't make love so much. Let's limit our growth. Come on. No, that's not what happens.
What happened to you while you were in jail?
I just went in jail when you said that, and now I'm out. Whoa! Oh, I talked about the beehive, how pollution is a sign it's a sign to change and move. Now, what happens in evolution and pedomorphosis and your question about the 60s, works like this. The dinosaurs have the turf deal down. The dinosaurs figured out that the bigger you are, the more armor plating. Listen, you become like you control that turf. You know, like a Sicilian mafia controls it, or like the Irish mafia controls it. No one's going to fuck with a kid of a dinosaur. So, there are more and more dinosaurs, and they're moving out, and they're eating all the, yeah, great, but with size and with armor plating goes you give away mobility. Mobility is nobility. The solution to almost every problem is move, either inward or outward. And the dinosaurs couldn't move. So, listen, it got to be a terrible situation. You talk about pollution, you talk about Times Square, you talk about the freeways of San Francisco. There were so many dinosaurs out there in the swamp sinking in, and the young dinosaurs took one look. There goes J. Edgar Hoover. There goes L.B. Johnson. There goes Mamie Eisenhower. We aren't going to grow up. And from the fetal or juvenile dinosaurs developed, as you probably know, winged creatures, the avian creatures who fly far and fast. So, the 1960s, to answer your question, was I could give you dozens of examples of how evolution works from the larvals and the juveniles. I'll tell you one more thing about human pedomorphosis. As you know, the key characteristic of the human species is we have not matured. We're embryonic. We haven't over-specialized yet. In Scientific America, about 3 years ago, there were these four X-ray photos of the skull of an embryonic chimp and of a human fetus, almost the same. An adult chimp with an enormous big jaw, adult human being, almost like the fetal human being and the fetal chimp. The implications are obvious. We didn't grow from the apes. We refused to become apes. And we... now, what happened in the... What happened in the 1960s was this. The time had come to avoid terminal adulthood. A generation of young people, and there I could spend hours giving you the ecological, historical, and genetic, biological, neurological things that happened to make that come, the first baby boom generation after Hiroshima and so forth. But that generation in the 60s, millions and millions of young people simply refused to buy the adult image, the adult model. And you had those incredible musical prophets and minstrels. And see, the interesting thing about the 60s was we were unified in the 60s because we all were refusing to identify with that adult authority. So there was that, Dylan was saying, she talks about man and God and law. She's 68, but she says she's 54. Well, I ain't going to work on Maggie's farm no more. And... the Beatles writing those songs about she's leaving home, what did we do wrong, can't get no satisfaction. Go right down the line, the great San Francisco sound groups. The signal is being sent out. We simply aren't going to over-specialize in the careerist 1950s. Don't worry, the 1970s are not like the 50s. The 1970s are highly individual and highly, a very fast-moving decade, but not visibly and not in the sense of demonstrations. one of the messages that I have right now is, the message is this. I don't advocate anything, but urge you to think it over. I urge you... I urge you at all costs to avoid terminal adulthood. What's going to happen? I think we're getting better. I'm better now than I was 10 years ago. I'm learning. I'm changing. I'm growing. You are too. What time is it? How long have I been talking? You want to take a break now or in 10 minutes? 10 minutes. Claire Frost has just arrived. Hey, dear. All right, we'll talk for 10 more minutes. All right. Yeah, well, if anyone is restless, get up, move around, listen. Yeah, I got a head full of ideas that are driving me insane, so. I don't think I have to talk about neurogeography. The principle is very simple. When you go back east, it literally is back east, you're going down in time and back in evolution. When you get... I know. You're not back there. I spent about a third, almost a half of my adult life in the old world, sometimes voluntarily and sometimes on the run. And it's not chauvinism to say that each kilometer that you move east, there's more reliance on tradition, there's more reliance on authoritarian setups, there's less confidence in individuality, there are more blocks to enthusiasm and to change. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. Matter of fact, if you really understand the principles of neurogeography, you can time travel. You know, like, you can go to Uganda. I think most smart people in Uganda have left. I once said, is there one intelligent person left in Uganda? And a guy said, yeah, one. And I know. Now, throughout evolutionary history, when you talk about geography, it's always a hot subject. You know, the Neapolitans against the Romans and the Carthaginians. There's always been this incredible tension. There's an incredible intense love affair going on now between California and New York and the East Coast, because that's the past capital and this is the forward. And there's always that. And of course, it has to do with style. It has to do with beauty. It has to do with individual. So therefore, it's very sexual and it's very, you know, and so forth. It's a place to be in this electricity between New York and San Francisco and L.A. And there's no chauvinism here. Go exactly to the place where you want your nervous system, get on, and then move to the time niche that... See, the point is, you know, when you look at a map, it's got those hours, those meridians. Those aren't hours, those are centuries.
You're listening to The Psychedelic Salon, where people are changing their lives one thought at a time.
When this talk makes it to the Internet Archive, you may want to listen to the last 20 minutes or so of the recording. And what you'll find is that this lecture quickly disintegrated into total chaos. There were people in the audience shouting questions, and Tim would start to answer one, but then someone would interrupt and say something funny that got him laughing so hard he couldn't talk. And it was amusing, but there really weren't a dozen coherent words left in the tape, and so I took the liberty of not playing it here. But before long, you'll have access to all of this material at the Internet Archive. And a huge thank you to all of you good folks over at the Internet Archive who are going out of your way to get some of the Leary Archive material online. I'm sure that the psychedelic community the world over sends you light and love for helping to preserve this wonderful little piece of our history. So, what do you think about Tim Leary's suggestion that perhaps half of our species has been born with a future nervous system? For me, that was a very synchronistic remark because of the conversation I had with Bruce Damer a week ago. I hope to podcast parts of that conversation, and in particular the part where Bruce was talking about what is happening to the nervous systems of people who spend a lot of time online or gaming. Now that I have this suggestion of Dr. Leary's in mind, the idea that people are being born with 22nd century nervous systems is going to give me a whole new way of thinking about some of the things that Bruce was talking about. Which is just my very long-winded way of saying that, for me at least, I found some of these ideas of Timothy Leary to be very much relevant today. My favorite thought, of course, was when he said, "The message is this. I don't advocate anything, but I urge you to think it over. I urge you at all costs to avoid terminal adulthood." And I can think of no better advice, whether you're 15 or 95. Avoid adulthood at all costs. It's a terminal disease, I'm told. Now, I want to mention a little personal connection that has come about because of these podcasts, and that is I heard from my friend Ken, who I shared some wonderful days with at one of the Palenque Ethnobotany seminars. Here's a part of what he had to say. Also, just a little plug you can mention to your listeners about the possible benefits of perusing your Amazon store. I recently got a hankering for some reading material and was checking out your Amazon store, and I noticed that Rick Strassman has a new book that was just released, which I bought, and I also came across a book I've heard you recommend highly on several occasions, that being Graham Hancock's Supernatural. Now, I really didn't pay too much attention to the condition of the copy I bought, but it turns out that I received a brand new 710-page hardcover edition complete with dust jacket and full-color plates for a paltry $5. I'm not sure why I got such a bargain, as the price is now listed at $19.77 or so. Still a great deal for a lot of book. I really lucked out, but another great reason that I like your Amazon store is that it helps, even in a little way, to keep the excellent podcast coming. Well, thanks for the plug, Ken, and like you say, every little bit helps. We don't make a lot of money from the Amazon store, but like you say, it all goes into the pot and keeps the bandwidth and disk space paid for, so thanks a lot. Ken goes on to say, "Lorenzo, I've also got to say that one of the things I really like hearing on your podcast is when you take the time to address the communications from younger, more isolated from the psychedelic community, people. I must say that I'm retrospectively envious of the world these young people are coming of age in. Of course, it will also chew them up and spit them out much more quickly than when I was a teen. It does seem that with all of the great informational resources available, like Arrowhead and Entheogen.com, your voice and perspective offers the personal human touch of wise, experience-based advice." Well, thank you for saying that, Ken, and thank you also for sending along those pictures from our days in Palenque. Believe it or not, I never got any pictures of my own while I was there, and so it's really great to revisit some of those memories. Another message that came in a while back was from Andy H., who said, "My name is Andy, and I'm a college student and studying philosophy and sociology. I took this past semester off to go to Peru for about 2.5 months after having the encouragement of listening to the vast majority of your generous library of downloadable podcasts. Towards the end of my trip, I had the privilege of making contact with Alan Shoemaker in Iquitos. There, he generously granted me access to just about any resource he had that I deemed necessary for my own personal journey. Anyways, after a relatively short stay there, as I was gathering my things from Alan's house, I told him about your website and podcast as something that had been inspirational to myself and apparently many others around the globe. This caught his attention very much, and he asked me if he could give me a DVD of the second annual shamanism conference that he'd held a couple years ago, and a flyer of information for his upcoming conference in July, and to send it along to you for podcasting if you'd be interested." Well, yes, that would be great, Andy, and another resource for anyone interested in Alan's annual shamanism conference, you might want to check out some of KMO's podcasts from the Sea Realm, where he has also played some of the material from Alan's conferences. In fact, if you're thinking about going to the Shamanism Conference this year, you might want to think about registering through KMO's site. That way he'll get a small commission and you'll have a friend in Peru to help you get into the flow of things. And I'll try to remember to put up links to both KMO's site and to Alan's site that discusses the Shamanism Conferences. And thank you, Andy, for the reminder about this conference coming up this July. I think it'd be really worthwhile for anybody that can get down there. Well, I guess that's about it for today. And as always, I want to close by saying that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are protected under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at psychedelicsalon.org. And that's also where you'll find the program notes for these podcasts. And for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.